It's been said that every quilt tells a story, and it's so true. But I also believe every quilter has a story to tell. I wanted to hear about the people behind these wonderful quilts and thought you'd enjoy hearing about their lives also. Welcome to A Quilter's Life. Lisa Shepherd Stewart encourages others to express themselves creatively through culturally relevant techniques and materials. Although she loves African fabrics with every fiber of her being, she also loves to learn and share about other cultures from around the world. This intro is going to be a bit longer than normal because during the interview, Lisa experienced an earthquake. I didn't want to leave that part in the middle of the interview, but I do want to share it. I edited it so you aren't hearing Lisa repeat, "Paula, hold on," in time between the statements as she was figuring it out. Then, after she called back, we had a little conversation about it. Also, I wanted Lisa to have this recording of a major event in her life. So glad that she was safe during this. When you're listening to the interview, you will hear a soft hum when I ask the question, "What message would you want to leave with them?" I believe that hum was the beginning of the earthquake. Here's our conversation after I heard that hum.
Hold on a second. There's something vibrating. One second. What is that? That can't be the wind. Hold on one second. I'm sorry, Paula. Wait one second. Because something was just vibrating. And we don't get earthquakes here.
What was that? What was that? Did you hear that?
Paula, hold on one second.
Uh-huh.
Something was vibrating.
Fuck, earthquake.
Yeah. I don't know if it was like the furnace or something.
That's scary.
Paula, wait, can I call you back? There's something weird going on.
Okay. We'll talk in a little bit.
Okay, I'll call you back as soon as I can.
All right.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
Back to early life.
Oh my God.
I'm sure that was on your bucket list to feel an earthquake.
I'm done now. I'm good. Oh my God. It was funny. I was at a trade show in Vegas many, many years ago. And there was an earthquake in LA. And when I was there, like 4 in the morning, we felt like the outer edge, you know, of it.
Yeah.
But I slept through it mainly. And then I heard something and everybody was just, you know, crazy. But that was like, I guess my first one. So this is like, but this is home. Oh my goodness. That was crazy. Okay. Wow.
Because that's a major event.
Yeah. When you're not used to them, especially, it's like, why is the room shaking?
Yeah.
And my husband said, we have a baby grand in the living room. And he said the piano was shaking. I was like, oh my God.
Wow.
So that's a lot to move. Okay. Here we go. I think I'll switch to water. Wow, crazy. All right, anyway, I'm good if you are, so let's do it.
Okay, now on to the interview. Lisa, it was so fun to meet you at QuiltCon at your booth.
Thank you. Yeah, we had a great show, and it was great to meet you, too. I'm looking forward to today.
Uh-huh. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in New York City, an area called Spanish Harlem. I'm not sure if it's even called Spanish Harlem anymore, but it's uptown. I was born to my parents and my older brother. At age 7, I moved to New Jersey, and I've been there ever since.
So do you remember anything about New York?
I do. We lived in an apartment. Yeah, it was just, you know, the early days. So it was just all about having fun and going to school. And it was just a very cool kind of upbringing. And the sewing came a little bit later. So I was just having a good time. And then, like I said, we moved to the suburbs. Yeah, just always had an inquisitive kind of creative mind and always loved the creative toys. Never really was into dolls or the domestic toys. I always liked the creative stuff, like light bright and Etch-a-Sketch and fashion plates, things like that.
Huh. How about a special childhood memory?
I had favorite pajamas that my mother told me I would never, ever wanted to take off. I just wanted to wear them all the time. And they were like a little floral, like, I guess, flannel pajamas. And that was one of my first favorite fabric, loves or something like that. Another one was my blanket, but just always had an interest in textiles. Never really talked about it. It wasn't anything I'd talk to other people, you know, or ask my mother about, but I just always had this interest in fabric and just touching it. And just to this day, obviously, you know, so that's always been a thing with me.
When you said florals, I'm trying to picture, were they bright or medium or a darker?
I guess it was like an ivory background with like kind of red cabbage rosy kind of, I don't know where we got them, but they were just my favorite. They were cuddly and it was just that whole tactile sense of fabric. That was probably my first experience with that. So I always remember that.
So cute. Other than your quilting, did you have other employment?
Well, aside from the early teen jobs, you know, fast food, things like that, I always had a job that was involved in fabric, in the sewing industry, the quilt craft industry. I went to FIT, Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, with the interest of sewing because I learned to sew at age 12. So I always had that, again, interest in textiles, and I decided to study marketing. So I always had a job in that industry and have always loved it. I always thought that if I had to work for a living, I should enjoy it. You know, not just not be tied to a desk and that kind of thing. So that was always my driving force in job hunting and kind of, I guess, building a career out of the fabrics.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned you started sewing at 12. Was that at school or at home or where?
That was actually at home. I wasn't one to really go to summer camp and that kind of thing. So one summer I was bored. My mother saw an ad for Singer back when Singer had stores in the mall, like way, way back. So she said, oh, they have sewing classes. Maybe you can try a sewing class. So at the same time, my grandmother, who before I was born, she was a seamstress. And then by the time I was born, she had gone into healthcare, but she had that sewing gene. I guess she passed it on to me. And she happened to win a sewing machine in a contest. And she gave it to me. She was, oh, maybe Lisa will get into the sewing, that kind of thing. So with the new machine and the classes in the summer at Singer, I just took off. It was like my new thing. I loved it. I sewed constantly. And then I went back after the summer. They had the same classes were during the school year, but on Saturdays. And I took another set of courses on Saturdays at Singer and just loved it. And I just have not turned back. I've gone through sewing machines and just really had a great time. So that was really the start at age 12. And that led me to go to FIT and study textiles and marketing.
What a wonderful way to keep you busy.
Yeah, my parents were happy. I was happy. You know, I was home. All I wanted was money for fabric. So that was easy. And I made things for the whole family. So that was a lot of fun, you know, especially my mother. I made a lot of dresses and things for her. And I had like found myself. It was great at that young age. So that helped me, again, guide the career, let me know that that's what I wanted to do for a living and just live in it and just be it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was great.
Well, you said you live in New Jersey now. How far away is it from where you were raised?
Well, right now I'm in Rahway, which is also where the business is. And that's about 40 minutes from Teaneck. Teaneck is closer to uptown New York City. And Rahway would be closer to like downtown New York City. So it's south of Teaneck. Yeah, about 40 minutes away. So gradually I had moved down. Different jobs kind of dictated where I was going to live because some of the jobs were in New Jersey and I wanted a shorter commute. So I would kind of come down gradually. So this is about my third place I'm living since the house I grew up in. So I just kind of gradually moved to different towns based on where I needed to be, but always within that same area. Some of my parents were getting older and they needed, you know, more help, that kind of thing. I was close enough to still be, you know, around.
Yeah, it's good to be able to help.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about the cost of living in that area.
Well, New Jersey is not cheap. New Jersey has lost people just because of some of the pricing, the property taxes. It's not super great. I think it's expensive because you do have access to New York and to Philadelphia if you're in South Jersey. And I guess they play on that because it's close to New York, but not in New York. So you kind of pay for that, I guess, privilege, if you want to call it that, or that convenience. So yeah, it's not cheap, but it's basically all I know. I guess if I were to move someplace else, it would seem more affordable. But I'm here and it hasn't driven me out just yet, I guess. Not that that day may not come, but so far, so good. We're making it happen.
Anything else about your family or early life you wanted to share?
There was another, aside from the pajamas, just to give you like a little early kind of a thing. I coined this term called fabricasm, which we'll get into later. And basically, it's kind of what it sounds like. Fabricasm is the name of my magazine and all that. And I realized that I experienced my first fabricgasm at the tender age of 4 because of those pajamas. And also I had a favorite blanket. And the blanket was like a loose weave. I was really enthralled by how all the threads just stayed together because it was just a woven fabric. And, you know, you have your warp and your weft. And those threads just kind of locked in and made a fabric that was like solid. I was just, I guess, mesmerized by that. So that was really the start of the whole fabricolic kind of thing. Yeah. And my mother always told me that I had a very definite sense of the fabrics I would like to wear and the fabrics I didn't want to wear. So even as she's dressing me as a young girl, young child, there were certain things I was like, nope, I don't want to wear that. And she said I always had a very definite feel for the fabrics I wanted to wear. So I thought that was interesting.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm picturing how my daughter reacted when I would braid her hair. If that braid wasn't straight, she could feel it in
yes.
that reaction. So to have that reaction to fabric.
Right. It was interesting. And when she told me about it in later years, I thought about it and I was like, yeah, I do remember not wanting to wear that skirt or not wanting to wear whatever. And it was just funny to me. But that's how far back the fabric thing goes. Like even before you're aware of it, you know, it's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. If you were to tell future generations about who you are, how would you describe yourself to them?
I guess as a person who's creative, not really just in the sense of putting fabrics together and that kind of visual creativity, but just creative in the way that I combine things. Like I was saying, how I wanted to be involved in fabrics for a living because I had to work for a living and I wanted to make sure that things were, you know, fun and interesting for me, even though I had to make a living. So just kind of the way I've been able to put things together, I guess, is another form of creativity. And then with that, I also like to help other people in that sense. So just kind of finding different ways to marry all my interests, whether it's writing or sewing or whatever it is, marketing, that kind of thing. And just kind of putting everything together to help myself and to help other people is probably how I'd like to be described.
And what message would you want to leave with them?
I would say find something to be passionate about. I find that to me, the most interesting and the most satisfied, happy people are people that have some kind of a passion. I don't care what it is. Like whatever your passion is, your niche, if you find it and you live for it, I think that's probably 99% of your happiness, honestly, if you can just kind of commit to it and enjoy it and make that part of your life. So I know a lot of people don't find that passion for a long time. Like they spend their whole lives trying to find it or whatever. I was lucky to find mine early and I wouldn't have changed anything. So find a passion, like a real one, not just one that everybody else is doing, but something that really means something to you and go for it.
It's fun to see that light bulb moment at times go on in people's lives when they start doing what they're called to do.
Right.
Well, besides quilting, are there other crafts that you have done in the past or that you do now?
I started more with the sewing. So for those who make the distinction of sewing and quilting, which I really don't, but I started sewing clothing and home deck and moved into the quilting. But a little bit of drawing, but nothing I would say that I've done a whole lot of. Really just crafts with fabric. Even if it's not where there's thread involved, like sewing and quilting, it may be decoupage, it could be collage, something like that. But it's always generally comes back to fabric for me. So that's kind of what I've centered on.
And how about other hobbies?
Travel, holistic health. I'd say that I'm a part-time vegetarian. So there's that. Things like yoga. And I'm into kind of self-knowledge things like handwriting analysis. I had written a paper in high school on handwriting analysis. And I really kind of got into that. It's called graphology. And just that whole thing of knowing yourself and seeing yourself in different ways, like through your handwriting or through anything, the way you dress or anything like that. That's always of interest to me.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting about the handwriting. I think I just saw a little bit about it. Like if people write small or big, those things tell a lot about us.
There's a lot to it. It's very interesting. It's everything from the kind of pen you like to use to the force you use on the paper, like how forcefully you use the pen, the sizes, the strokes. It's really, really very interesting. But now we do so much by keyboard. We've lost a lot of that. It's just gone away because now you even have like e-signatures. You really can't do anything with that. So it's just changed a lot. what they call progress, you kind of lose things in the process. Something like graphology, where everybody writes differently, you lose that. I still enjoy that whole idea of knowing about someone through their handwriting. It's fascinating.
Yeah. I was picturing, as you said, about the computer. Well, mm-hmm. I guess we could watch them and see how hard they hit the keys.
I guess. It's not the same. It's kind of like they said, hanging up on a person, like that satisfaction, like slamming a phone down on someone. Like, you don't get that with a cell phone because you can't really slam a cell phone. So it's that kind of, you lose in the translation, I guess.
Do you think any of your hobbies show up in your quilting?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. Most of what I do is still fabric-based, even if it's not stitching and, you know, thread-based. So it's already kind of interwoven, I guess. Yeah, I'm not sure that they do. I think it's just kind of, the quilting is so much of it, it just kind of consumes everything, I guess. So I don't know. But I can pinpoint, you know, one thing that goes back to the quilting or however.
It sounds like it's been so involved in your life that you mm-hmm. probably can't differentiate between the two, if it is.
Right. I think that's a lot of it. I don't even see it anymore. It's just one. It's just all kind of goes together. You're right.
Well, we talked about how you learned to sew, but mm-hmm. who introduced you to quilting?
Well, quilting came about, like I said, I always had a job in the industry. So I was working for a company called HTC or Handler Textiles. If you go way back, you might even remember that name. And they did things like fusible interfacings for sewing, you know, when you're sewing garments and you need the inner structure, that kind of thing. So we did interfacing and interlinings. And then we started more of a quilt division because quilting was coming up more. And we did things like batting and fusible kind of trans web and fusible, all kinds of things. And my job there was creative director. So I was tasked with finding products for the industry and testing them, making the samples and all that kind of thing, which included quilting. And so that's kind of how I got into it, is through the job. So again, everything kind of molds together, you know, the personal and the work and all that. So I just kind of developed products and really didn't know about quilting, but I learned quickly and I loved it. And it was a nice offshoot to the sewing I had, you know, already been doing my whole life, like the, you know, garment sewing and home deck and things like that. And I liked the idea that I could incorporate quilting, like to do maybe like a piece jacket. And so it's still fashion, but it's also quilting. Things just flowed that way. And I just got more into it. So I got into quilting, to answer your question, through my work.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So you got paid to do what you love.
Exactly. And that was always kind of like my goal. Like, I want to have fun at work. I don't want to just get a paycheck. Right. So I was able to learn on the job and then develop from there and make new fun stuff. All my jobs were fun. I can't tell you one job that I hated. Always stayed at my jobs for a long time and just always had a good time.
Wow. Now, whether it's a quilt you made or someone else made, do you have a favorite quilt?
Probably not just one, I would say, because I think I would categorize a little bit. I might say this is my favorite Ankara quilt, which would be African prince. This is my favorite mud cloth quilt. This is my favorite petite quilt. Because I couldn't pick just one, so I would give myself categories so I could have like maybe 10 different ones. Just kind of cheat around it. Yeah, I can't even pick just one, but there's so much out there. I mean, when you think of how many quilts and how many designs and how many fabric combinations, and it's staggering. So I'm sure I have more than 10.
Wow.
Yeah.
With all the tools that we get to use in making our quilts, do you have a tool you are so happy that you have?
Interestingly enough, I always tell people that I'm not gadget girl when it comes to quilting. I know some people love the gadgets and they love the tools. I rarely even use rulers. Honestly, I eyeball so much and I'm trying to think of something that I can tell you, yes, I love to use this. Nothing really stands out. And even threads, I generally stick to certain colors of thread for the basic work. And I only buy a special color if I need that for like a top stitch or something visible. So I really just, you know, stick with the basics and just kind of work that way. I can't even think of anything, to be honest. I mean, just, you know, good scissors, good rotary cutters, like the basic tools. I like to have good versions of those, I guess you can say.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just because I don't do the techniques that require all those gadgets, but yeah, I just kind of freestyle a lot of it. And there may be a tool that would make my life easier, and I just don't know about it because I'm not plugged into the whole tools and gadgets end of the spectrums. But I do okay.
Well, you've been sewing long enough that you know what you want to pull and put together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in our quilting process, there's so many steps. Is there a step that you enjoy more than the other steps, or do you like each step along the way?
I love the step of auditioning fabrics for certain projects and pulling fabrics together and making sure they play well together. And I love the piecing and the cutting and the putting together of the tops. The quilting end of it, the finishing is not my favorite part. So I use a lot of upholstery fabrics in my quilts because I use different weights of fabric altogether. I mix whatever I feel like, whatever wants to play together, I let them play together. So it might be in different weights of fabric. And I found that there are various upholstery fabrics that look like they're quilted. They have that, you know, quilting stitches, or they just have a, like maybe a scroll design or whatever kind of stitching it has, and it looks like it's quilted. So I employ those because it looks like it's quilted, and that's less quilting that I have to do. So just things like that, just little creative, you know, hacks and things like that. But definitely the piecing and the bringing together of all the parts and playing with them and letting them do what they want to do and then stitching them together, and then they're all happy, hopefully. But yeah, piecing over the actual quilting part.
Huh. You just mentioned using upholstery fabrics quite a bit, but I know you like using African textiles, or you do a lot with that. So are there African textiles in the upholstery fabrics too?
There are African textiles that I like to use, like bogolan, or some people call it mud cloth. Mud cloth is like the nickname for bogolan. That's more of a weight that's closer to an upholstery fabric. It's thicker than basic quilting fabric. So I'll use them together because the weights work well together. And this way I can add some texture with the upholstery fabric, and then the design comes from the mud cloths. And then there are also mud cloth designs made into commercial upholstery fabric. So there's always kind of a mix back and forth of the designs and how they're used. So yeah, you can have upholstery fabric that looks like a mud cloth, or you can have real mud cloth. You can pair them together, and there's always like a nice way to mix them.
Wow, there's so much to learn.
I definitely like to not always stick to quote unquote quilting fabric, like the lightweight cottons. Like I said, I like to mix all different things, like dupioni silks. I like to pull in raw silks that are like linen weight. Speaking of linen, that too, and denim and duck and canvas. I just like to mix different things. I think it just gives, you know, a different look and a different kind of a feel to the project.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about fabric here. I had another question on the African textiles.
Mm-hmm.
Do you actually get the textiles from Africa, or where are they made?
I go to Ghana regularly and I get the Jacquard batiks, and they make a batik I haven't seen anywhere else in the world. They use the base fabric, which is like a damask or a Jacquard fabric. Remember the old tablecloths, the table linens with the woven designs?
Mm-hmm.
They use that as the base cloth and do the batik over it. So you kind of get two different effects in the fabric. And I haven't seen anyone else use that kind of fabric for batik. So I get that specifically from about three different women in Ghana that make it for me. And I sell their fabrics. So those I get directly from Ghana, and also some other batiks, you know, plain weave cottons. I get those too. The African prints I get from dealers either here in the U.S. or I source those from Ghana as well. But they're actually made all over the world now. So there are a lot of African, quote unquote, prints made in China. It got to the point I have a whole separate lecture on just Kara and the whole history of it. It's pretty fascinating. But long story short, they're made all over the world now. They're made in India, they're made in Africa, they're made all over. So those, you never exactly know where it's been made unless you see it come off the boat or something. So they're kind of an international fabric now, but they're still regarded as African prints because of the designs and everything. And then I get fabrics from Central Africa. The Kuba fabrics, they're made with raffia, like palm tree fibers. So those I generally get from dealers here in New York. So there are people that I work with, importers that know what I like, and, you know, they'll contact me and I'll go over and get some things from them. So there's that too. So I don't really travel to all the places I get fabric from, but I'd like to.
I know you've been to Ghana. So have you actually gotten to see the fabric being made?
If you're talking about the batik fabrics, we've not only seen them made, we've made them ourselves, because I had done four group trips to Ghana, taking groups over to Ghana And a big part of that was the textiles and the crafts and the bead work and all that. So we actually planned workshops with the artisans there. So we actually made some of the batik ourselves. So that was a whole experience. There's another fabric called Adinkra fabric, which is like a funeral fabric made in Ghana. And it's stamped with different symbols that have different meanings. So we made some Adinkra cloth. So we had those experiences of hands-on and seeing all the effort that goes into these fabrics. You don't even want to bargain, because normally you would bargain the price, and that's part of the whole culture. And you see how much work goes into it. You don't even want to bargain with the people. It's like, here, just take my money. So you get such an appreciation for all the work that goes into it and all the thought and the design. It's labor intensive and just the time-honored traditions and all that. So we've actually had some experience making it ourselves, and also weaving kente cloth. Kente is made in narrow strips. The strips are sewn together, and then the garment's worn like a toga, kind of like thrown around your shoulder. And to see how the kente cloth is woven, it's fascinating. So we've got a little taste of all of those in those trips that I had done. I hadn't done one since 2013, as far as the group trips, but we've actually had a taste of it, and you really get a whole appreciation that you don't get just looking at a picture.
Did you video any of that?
I'm sure we have video. I'd have to find it. It's somewhere like on a computer or something. I know I have photos, but the video is around, buried someplace. So yes.
It would just be so interesting to see. I was wondering if you had something out there.
I don't have anything posted. I probably do need to do that. But yeah, it's something to see. And it's even better to do, like if you can go and do workshops like that and that kind of thing. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, very cool.
Boy, it's hard to segue back onto my list.
We got off on a tangent.
Well, Lisa, can you share your worst quilting experience?
So I told you when I was 12, my grandmother won the sewing machine and gave it to me. So I was on maybe my second machine after that. Because like I said, I'd really gotten into the sewing. The machines got workouts and I really used them. To the point where I burnt out the motor. And I think it was my second machine. I'm about maybe at this point, 13, 14 years old. I didn't realize that machines needed maintenance because what do I know? I'm just sewing and the machine's moving and I'm breezing through making all these things. And to the point of like, it started to smoke and it smelled. It was just like burnt out the motor. I had no idea I'd done that. So that was probably not one of my best moments. But I was happy that that happened at age 14 with a sewing machine. Because by age 17, when I got my first car, I realized, okay, you have to maintain motors. You can't just let them go. Better to learn that on a sewing machine than like a whole car. So I learned very quickly that, okay, you have to maintain things. So that was probably like one of my not best moments. It was interesting. It was a valuable lesson. And I only had to learn that once. So that was a good thing.
It's amazing how these lessons help us along the way.
Yes, definitely. My first car, I was very meticulous with the maintenance and, you know, I got the oil changed. I knew everything I had to do and I did it. And I've never had a problem with the cars. Thanks to the sewing machine.
Why do you make quilts? What has drawn you to continue making quilts and working with fabric rather than doing anything else with your time?
A couple of things. I think I'm just inspired by the fabric itself. And I'm talking mainly about the African fabrics that I kind of deal with, but all fabric in general, but those in particular. Just thinking about the person that made that fabric and like what they intended for it to be and what they intended someone to make out of it, or if they intended someone to make something out of it. And I just kind of, again, going back to having fun with the auditioning phase of quilting and, you know, trying things out and how would these work together. And just kind of that whole exercise of just colors and patterns and what works. So I think that's really just kind of what drew me into quilting, as opposed to if I make a dress, it's one fabric I'm working with. Generally, you make the dress, then it's one fabric. But the quilting is a whole nother level of creativity because you are actually building the fabric yourself. So I think that's what draws me more to quilting as opposed to other things, either with fabric or with other forms of art. Because I've had people that do painting, like customers and students and things that maybe they've come from painting or other art practices. And they say that when they came to fabric, it just kind of changed and they'd never gone back. So there's something about fabric that people that don't even realize what's happening. It's a different way of working. I think it's always held my interest and my attention. So here I am.
While you were explaining that, I started wondering, do you remember the first time you saw an African textile and what drew you to that?
I do, I think. So my first trip to the African continent was to Senegal, and that was 1986. It was a group out of Chicago, like a cultural group. They said, oh, we're going to Senegal. If you have any special interests, we can hook you up with people on the other end, you know, so to make your time more enjoyable, however. And I said, just point me to whatever fabric-related people you can find. So they connected me with one of the major mills at the time called Sotiba in Senegal. They made wax prints and they made Ankara and all kinds of things. So they connected me with the marketing director. And I'm about 21 at this point. So the marketing director happened to be this young, handsome man. He drove a white Peugeot. And we just spent kind of the afternoon and he was telling me all about the fabrics and he had me in the showroom, the whole thing. So that was one of my first, I guess, experiences with African fabrics. I brought home two duffel bags of batik and, you know, all kinds of prints from that Senegal trip. And that really started me with the African textiles. So from there, I just started to do some research and, you know, try to find more of it. Wasn't as much of an internet kind of a thing, or, you know, shop online. We didn't really have that yet. So it was a little bit harder to find things, but I found some things. Then I found myself on a fabric shopping trip in Hong Kong with a group of ladies and said, so we're going to go fabric shopping. And, you know, they did different fabric type trips. And I said, well, there's no other reason I'd ever go to Hong Kong except to buy fabric. So let me go buy fabric. And over there, I found an African art gallery in Hong Kong. And that's when I was introduced to Kuba cloth. And it's spelled K-U-B-A, Kuba cloth. It's from Central Africa. And I think I mentioned before, it's like raffia, like palm tree fibers. So I bought a piece and it was expensive for my standards at that point, but I had to have it. It was one of those things you see, you don't even question, you just have to have it. And I brought it home and I started to research about Kuba cloth and learn more about it. And that began that whole collection. And then I got into mud cloth and things like that. And I just never looked back. There was always something new to discover. And then the stories behind the fabrics, like why they're made, how they're made. I was into all of that. So it was always some new discovery and to build on what I'd learned before. And it just kind of continued. There were still things now that I'm still researching and looking into and discovering. So there's always something there.
Cool. Thank you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you make your quilts for?
The quilts that I make personally, I literally make personally just for my own enjoyment, either, you know, in our house or however. A lot of my quilt making goes toward the business, whether it's a class sample or something like that. But it's always something that I want to maybe have in my house afterwards. So I guess I'm always thinking this has to work with what I'm doing or what I want to show or what I want to have in my house, because once it's a sample and it's done, it'll just be there. So it kind of has to do like double duty. So really a lot of what I do is for the business. But again, it's so entwined with the rest of my life. It's kind of hard to even draw that line. Which is good, because then when I make something, I know it's something I'm going to like. So, I'll also do colors and things that won't go with my house, because I can't just have the same color all the time, which is like brick red and, you know, earth tones. So I do things in purples and other colors, but it has to resonate with me. Otherwise, I can't make it.
Well, even if you're doing a class and you do one color, the students will pull their own colors. So
Right. Exactly. And I do try to make other colors just so it's not, everything isn't brick red. And sometimes I notice that if I'm doing a trunk show and I'm like, that's too much brick red. I have to show some of the colors. Because they'll think that's like all I do, but you know.
Well, you mentioned you weren't working on a quilt right now. Do you have another project going on?
Actually, I have some things I need to finish. I have a couple of UFOs I'd like to kind of commit some time to before I start something else. I am working on a dollhouse, which is going to be a window display for the studio. And I found this modern design dollhouse that I'm making African accents to go with it. I'm going to kind of get that into the window sooner than later. Before I start a whole new project that I feel like I have to finish, I'd like to devote some time to the dollhouse. And that means making little like mud cloth rugs and little wall hangings and things like that. So it's going to be fun.
That will be so cute.
That's a rabbit hole I never expected to fall down, this dollhouse rabbit hole, because you go on like Etsy and you can buy all the little furnitures and it's amazing. It's like a cult, but it's great. I'll be posting pictures when I put it in the window. But like I said, it's a rabbit hole. It's like I had to, you know, dig myself out. I'm like, I have work to do. I can't be on here just buying little beds. I bought a chaise lounge and recovered it. I mean, it's you can really get like lost. So it's been interesting.
It will be fun to see those pictures.
Yeah, it's going to be really cute, I think. And hopefully inspirational. Like, oh yeah, I can make a quilt for my bed. It's supposed to be a selling tool, quote unquote, but it's just fun.
Oh yeah. People are yeah. going to love that.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to that.
Do you have a quilting tip?
I would say try a new fabric that you've never used before in quilting. I mean, just that simple. Something you've just never used before. You've never put like a little bit of denim in a quilt. I mean, it'd have to be a whole quilt because that's more of a commitment. Maybe it's going to be like a little pouch, a little bag, a pillow, just something kind of small where you can experiment and just try a different fabric. Mix it in with the fabrics you have. So I think you can discover something that you never really thought about. You know, sometimes as quilters, we just always think quilt shop fabric. And you kind of get into that mindset. There's a lot there to be had and there's a lot of variety, but it just can open up other ideas and other avenues if you just kind of just throw in something different once in a while.
I can see a lot of us searching and finding mm-hmm. something new. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You might have an old upholstered pillow, like take that apart or, you know, do something with that. And, you know, repurpose things. That's the big deal now. That's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just kind of make new combinations that aren't always the same weight or aren't always the same look or the same texture. Just kind of have fun.
Well, you always got to work in a lot of textile or fabric jobs, mm-hmm. but describe how you went from having quilting as a hobby and it became a business for you.
It kind of grew together. It wasn't like the usual kind of path, I don't think. When people see it, it's like, oh, that's how it happened. Since I learned about quilting through the job, like I mentioned at HTC, the hobby and the job kind of grew together. So I was at HTC before I'd written my first book. I wrote 3 books. The first one is African Accents, Fabrics and Crafts to Decorate Your Home. It's now out of print, but it came out in 1999. With that, that's kind of, I guess, how the business started. Like the business meaning Cultured Expressions, which is kind of the umbrella company that I have. The company started with that because I had to, you know, promote the book and then everything. So as it was growing as a personal interest, it was also growing as a business almost at the same time, which is kind of strange. Most people like quilt for 20 years and they want to open a quilt shop. So long story short, first book came out. I began to do, you know, lectures for guilds and that kind of started the business. And because of the fabrics I was using, they weren't your typical quilt shop fabrics. They were mud cloth and things like that, Ankara, like I said. So I had to become the outlet for the fabrics. So that's how the merchandising part of the business started. And different pieces just kind of came together. And then I was doing workshops and classes and lectures. So everything just kind of came into being, I guess, organically. Like I'm not a business plan kind of person. So I just, things grew and I just kind of developed them and trial and error kind of thing. I don't know if I could really say that it was a hobby and then became a business. They just kind of happened at the same time. And the hobby and the business are so intertwined. It's just, it's hard to tell which is which. I mean, I do have separate stashes. Like I have merchandise for the studio and I have my own stash. So that's very distinct in my mind. But aside from that, it's just one big party. So yeah, I just kind of did that. And then the second book is Global Expressions, because I realized in my own work, I liked bringing in fabrics from other cultures in addition to the African fabric. So I had like Indian silks and block printed fabrics, things like that. So that was, again, based a lot on the cultures of the fabrics and how they use them. And I always liked the backstory of the fabrics. So I'd explain that. And then here's how you can make a lookalike, or here's how you can use it to make a room accent, that kind of thing. And so Cultured Expressions was just moving along and that whole thing. And then wrote a third book called On the Go, which was handbags that came out in 2007. So I was always writing in addition to the quilting and the sewing. So I was a freelance writer for Sew News Magazine, like back when it was on newsprint. I don't know if you remember that. Sew News Magazine was on newsprint before it was a magazine. And I was always writing for trade magazines for everybody. And so those two, you know, the writing and the sewing were always together. So it just kind of developed into different things. So all of that to say, the hobby and the business grew together and they kind of morphed onto each other, I guess you can say, and influenced each other.
What is the name of your business and how did you come up with the name?
The business is called Cultured Expressions. I didn't want to include the name African in the business name because I thought it may be something else beyond that at one point. I didn't want to kind of pigeonhole it. Cultured, I thought what I wanted to really do was elevate and really show off the cultures that create the fabrics. So Cultured Expressions just kind of came about and it seemed like it would fit. And also I could grow into it. I wouldn't outgrow it as far as maybe I wanted to do other fabrics later and include them. So it just seemed like a nice solid name. Just kind of did that. And then my 800 number is 866 Mud Cloth. So you can kind of tell what my favorite fabric is, Mud Cloth. And I've had that since about 2001. It just kind of grew somewhat, I guess, organically. It grew based on input from customers and students. It grew based on my own interests and, you know, things that I saw in the market. And it grew things that I thought maybe were lacking that I thought, you know, there was an outlet or an interest in it and just kind of moved from there.
You said you started selling the fabrics that you had been talking about. So mm-hmm. I assume that's when you opened your shop.
No, I had actually only sold online and at shows like Quilt Expo, or I would sell at a lot of the local, you know, quilt shows. They would have vendors, things like that. And I did that from 2002 until about 2017. I wasn't the typical quilter who dreamed of having a quilt shop. That wasn't really what I wanted. But 2017 came and the part-time job where I was, there were rumors that it was going to kind of not be around too much longer. And I thought, what am I going to do? Should I get another part-time job or should I just, quote unquote, hire myself and really just do something? And maybe it's time to do a little retail space. A lot of other factors kind of came into play because Rahway, New Jersey, where I live now, was getting more like an artsy vibe. Like there were, you know, galleries and things opening up and restaurants, and they were really developing the whole downtown here where I am. And I thought they need some African fabric on Main Street. That would be a nice addition. So that was partly it. And then, like I said, the part-time job where I was, it seemed like it was in jeopardy, maybe not going to be around too long. So all these factors kind of came together. I said, maybe it is time to do something more, you know, brick and mortar. I could have more classes. Up until then, I'd have classes at my house in my basement, but I could only have people that I knew. You can't invite the whole public to your house. So that was a little touchy. My husband's like, okay, enough with that. So it allowed me to have a space to have, you know, more have events and things like that. So it took until 2017, really, and the end of 2017 to really even want or to kind of get into the whole idea of doing brick and mortar. And now I love it. I love being here. People like the vibe and they come in and they're like, wow, you know, so it's been a definite plus for the business and it's just been a lot of fun. I love it.
And the brick and mortar survived the pandemic. How did that go?
It went better than I would have even expected, because just the other day I was mentioning to a friend that I've been open about 6 years and half of that time was during the pandemic. And that whole time was really actually gave a boost to sewing businesses in general, because people were home. They were focused on home activities. They were making masks. They were spending so much time at home. I realized people would look at their decor and say, oh my God, this place looks awful. I want to make a pillow or something like that. And they were home and they had time. So sewing, cooking, and gardening were like the three big things because everybody was home and had time and everybody got into the whole thing. So I was busier than I expected to be, because when they first introduced the lockdown and, you know, everything shut down, we can't do anything. I thought like everybody else, okay, I'm going to be home. I'm going to work on some projects and get some things done. It, you know, we'll do what we have to do. But I was busier than ever because everybody else was home and they needed fabric to do what they were going to do. And even though I couldn't be open as a brick and mortar, I could come in myself. I could still ship packages. I couldn't have anybody in the store, but I could still function, you know, with the shipping. And everybody wanted everything. I had to find new ways to source fabric. So there were some challenges, but it was a huge boost to the business, to be honest. And I was playing with the idea of doing virtual classes before the pandemic, like, oh yeah, that'd be nice. It was kind of like a side thing and I'll get to it when I get to it. So here comes the pandemic and myself and every other quilt teacher that I know were like, what are we going to do? And any other teacher, you know, how are we going to teach? Can we do this online? So that was a whole crash course of getting that together and getting classes online and getting them recorded. Like I said, every other quilt teacher that I know, we were all in this whole thing. And even outside of the quilting industry, everybody was scrambling. How do we bring this to online and how do we survive the pandemic and keep the company going? And so it was the push that I needed to do that. It was good, actually. I mean, as far as business, obviously it was a horrendous time, but as far as business, it was interesting. It was very interesting.
Yeah.
I would be here in the studio until like 1 a.m, shipping orders. It was a lot. I mean, you either do that or you retire early. A lot of people did retire early.
Yeah.
And just say, this isn't for me. We can't keep up with it. Or, you know, however. And but those that stuck with it really saw results, I think. It was fascinating.
It was interesting to see all the changes.
Yes. And all the communities, everybody doing lives and staying connected. And we saw that quilting and sewing and all that whole fabric connection, for a lot of us, it maintained our sanity. It was a big deal. We saw how important it really is to have that creative outlet. So people like me that were selling the fabrics, we had to keep people going, you know, so it was just figure out a way and ship and do everything we had to do. In 2018, just before the pandemic, I had started doing virtual visits where you can shop by, well, now Zoom appointment, but before it was more like Google Duo or FaceTime, however, you know, that kind of technology. And then with the pandemic, Zoom came in. So just before the pandemic, like I said, 2018, I started offering people that you could shop virtually. Like we had to make an appointment. I take you around the store with my cell phone and show you things and we can ship it. So here comes the pandemic. Everybody's on Zoom. And that was most of my business, was just doing virtual visits all day and shipping out orders. It really made you kind of figure out new ways to do business. And that goes back to that creativity. Like I'm saying, you have to figure out ways to create what you need to do, how to get things done. So it was a real mental exercise, but those who survived, survived. It was a lot.
I'm going to jump back to, you mentioned that you started having classes at home, but that had to be your friends. So when you started having classes at your shop, mm-hmm. and you opened it up to the public, do you remember when someone that you didn't know personally signed up for one of your classes?
Yeah, I do. But then what was interesting was, as quilters, we kind of feel like we know each other a little bit anyway, like you have that familiarity. So it wasn't that it was, I realized I was opening a public space. So it wasn't that, I mean, people were going to come in. That was the whole point. So, I was happy when they came in. But yeah, it was interesting. You just made new friends. When quilters get together, you're instant friends, right? No matter what style, if you have different styles or whatever, you just have that common, oh, you're a quilter? Okay, we're friends, that kind of thing. So it's like a meeting place for people to kind of, you know, come and meet other people that were into the same thing. So that was kind of what I wanted to do too, is have like a little community space where people who had this interest, you know, could kind of come in, or who were interested in maybe trying it, you know. So I did like a sewing 101 class. I still do that today. Just kind of getting people in here and getting them to touch the fabric and experience it and that kind of thing. But yeah, it was great. It was interesting. But like you say, when the first person who I didn't know, it kind of takes me back to when I first started with the online orders. So my first website was like in 2002, I guess. And the first time I got an order, just that feeling of, wow, this really resonated with somebody and they put money and they really want to buy it. It just kind of does something to you, like that someone really responds to what you're doing.
Uh-huh.
So, and each time I have a new product, I still get that feeling when the first person orders it, I'm like, wow, this is really something. That doesn't really leave you. It's like every time it's something new, it's like, who's going to really go for this? So, so I still get that feeling.
Well, thank you for giving me a copy of your magazine when we were at QuiltCon.
Yes, you're welcome.
You have made such a wonderful product and its quality.
And thank you.
Looking through it, I'm thinking, oh, there's so much in here. How can you even put out another issue? Because you've covered so much in this one.
It seemed like there's always something to cover, you know? And it's like, I didn't really feel like I had another book in me at the time when I started writing, putting out Fabrigasms. I said, well, I'll just put out a little magazine and it's whatever at the moment I'm feeling like sharing. And it's just like a fun way to kind of do things, and it kind of developed. And people look forward to it now. So it's just kind of fun to put out there.
And tell us a little bit more about the name of your magazine.
Well, usually I think it doesn't really require any explanation. People like giggle and I was like, okay, she gets it, you know. But yeah, Fabrigasm, and if you have it there with you on page 3, I always have the definition of Fabrigasm, which is a special feeling you get when you encounter a special textile, and it's just that take your breath away kind of a, you know, Fabrigasm. So yeah, that's I think it's self-explanatory. I don't know.
But that is cute. I just opened it up and you even have it down as a noun and it's written out like a dictionary.
It's a real definition because, when someone says, what's a fabergasm? Here it is. So, or it's the intense or unrestrained pleasure caused by the thought of using a fabulous textile in a particular project. And that kind of sums it up. Like when you just gasp, that's it. When people come in here and they look at a particular fabric and they're like, oh my God, it's like one of those. So yeah, just use your imagination. But it's just like a fun title. It just kind of captured the way we feel about African textiles. And if you do feel that way, then you'll enjoy the magazine. It's that kind of thing. So just some inspiration and maybe one or two recipes and, an interview and that kind of just fun stuff.
Like I said, you had so much in it. That's great.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's an action-packed 28 pages, no ads. It's just all me just going on about whatever. But I have a good time with it. So I'm glad you liked it.
You said that rather than put out another book, you decided to put out a magazine. Is that how it came about?
It is. Like I said, the writing and the sewing always went together as far as interests. And I wanted to keep writing, but I really wasn't doing as much of the freelance writing that kind of, I wouldn't say it dried up, but it just, I wasn't really doing that for other magazines. And I just put out one issue. And I think the first one was free. It was like a PDF just to kind of see. Everybody loved it. And it was like, oh yeah, this is great. So then I thought maybe I could really do this. And then it was, do I want to really do a whole magazine with advertising and the whole thing? And I realized I didn't have it in me to do, because I might as well do a book at that point. Right? So there's no schedule to it. It's about one issue a year is what I can get out just time-wise and everything. So it just comes out when it comes out. And I put it on the website. I let my tribe know. It's like, okay, it's out. And everybody buys it. And, we enjoy it. But there's no schedule. You can't subscribe to it because I don't know when the next one's coming out. So I don't, I don't want to get letters. Hey, where's my magazine? Because if I spoil the fun for myself, like no one's going to have a good time, right? So it has to be fun for me. That's my first rule. If I'm not enjoying it, I think it's going to show, first of all. Then if I don't have joy in it, I can't spread the joy to other people. So if it becomes like a labor and a whole, just an effort or something I'm just kind of doing begrudgingly, I think that's going to show in the product. So when I say I have to have fun for me first, that really is like a thing, because it reflects in the work, I think. So if I'm having a good time and I teach a class, everybody else is going to have a good time.
Yeah.
It's just like putting on your own mask first. They say like when the pressure drops in the plane, put your own mask on. It's something like kind of like that. Yeah. So I just have a good time with stuff.
In your magazine, you talk a little bit about the social impact fundraising platform.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Social impact is spelled SEWCIAL. It's like an arm of Cultured Expressions where I want to just kind of do something more for other people. And I ended up, the last trip I made to Ghana was last year. And I have a friend who started a school during COVID because his own children couldn't get to school. And things were not as solid as, obviously during COVID, everything kind of fell apart. So he actually started a school in his area and his three children attended. And maybe they started with like another 6 or 8 kids. They now have 128 students and they go from nursery and childcare age to what we consider about second grade, like 7-year-olds. The school is growing and they're accredited, the whole thing. So I went and I was so impressed. And I said, I want to adopt the school under Cultured Expressions. We'll do some fundraising and we'll just keep you in the public. And we want to really do something and help you and help us and just do the whole thing. Part of that was just my connection to Ghana, because Ghana has played a big part in my business as far as, just fabric resources and culture and all that. So just a way to give something to Ghana. And this personal friend of mine, he's just an amazing young man. And I went to his wedding in 2016 and the whole thing. So now they have 3 kids already. It's like a whole thing. His name is Philip. So with social impact, I wanted to kind of give a little bit more formal kind of a umbrella to the fundraising, because it makes it, just more legitimate and more ongoing, like it's a real project. So we've done some auctions. We auction off sewing related things or quilt related things that would appeal to my customers, that kind of thing. So we've raised some money through auctions. I'm going to do some giveaways and just straight donations we accept. And the money has so far gone to whatever the kids need. And like I said, the school is growing, so they're building onto it. And so they've done some construction with some of the funds we've raised. So far, we've raised about maybe $3,000. And it may or may not sound like a lot, but there it goes a long way. So it goes to, again, whatever they need at that time. They had needed some doors and windows repaired and that kind of thing. Now they're building on more classrooms and things. So it's just amazing to see what can be done with a little bit. A little bit, like maybe sometimes in our eyes, it doesn't seem like a lot, but It goes, like I said, a long way. And people that donate get, you know, a little button. So we're just building it to be an ongoing platform, fundraising kind of a thing. I'm anxious to see where it's going to go. And I'm excited that we can do something with them and for them. It's just been fun so far. So yeah, we're just working on some new ways to fundraise and build up what we can.
So cool.
Thank you. And we actually have one product in particular. It's a reversible Ankara tote. It comes with two fabrics and the instructions and a donor button. So part of the proceeds from that purchase go directly to the school. And on some days we'll have on the website, it'll be a donation day. So you don't have to donate money, but whatever you spend, you donate 10% of the sales. You put it a day or a week, however long we do it, to social impact. And just finding different creative ways to help. It's been fun for me to kind of do that.
Oh, neat. You said that's a bag. And I'm looking at a bag on the front cover of your magazine. I'm wondering if
that's the one. That is the one. Yeah. So inside it kind of explains what that's all about. That actual bag on the cover. Mm-hmm. I was carrying that bag around during my last trip in Ghana because it was just, you know, like a simple, quick bag. And I was carrying it a lot. And sitting down with him and with the teachers and kind of just, you know, meeting the kids and all that, I had the bag with me. And that's where I got the kind of the idea that if I tie this bag and make it a kit and tie it into the school, that would be kind of a nice way to start some things going. So the sales of the kit have been really great. And I'll probably come out with some other kits and things that are tied directly to the school. But in the meantime, like I said, donations are welcome and people can kind of go on the website at culturedexpressions.com and just kind of, you know, see what we're doing. I put updates on there and we're going to start another auction probably a week or so. So I try to keep the auctions going, keep the interest going. So it's just a whole nother way to just spread what we do and to just kind of promote it, I guess.
Now, did you become connected with Ghana on that first trip you took to that group in Chicago?
No, the Chicago group was Senegal. I went to Ghana the first time in 2001, and I was invited by a company called Navica, N-O-V-I-C-A, Navica.com. And Navica is a worldwide platform for artists that couldn't otherwise be seen, you know, around the world. It gives them a platform to sell their craft. And so artists literally all around the world. So long story short, I was writing my second book and I found some photography that they had done and I wanted to use it in my book. So I wrote to them and I said, I'm writing a book. Can I use this photo? And you know, the whole thing. And they said, oh, you're a writer. And they said, would you like to come to our West African office and cover the artists? We want to get some publicity for them. Come back to the States and write about it. And before they finished the sentence, I had hung up the phone and packed my bag. I was like, yes, I'm going. So I went, I did that. Met all kinds of people and we met the king and it was a whole experience. It was myself, the Navica representative and a videographer who was based in LA. So they invited him, you know, to do video and me to write. And we covered the artists and that was a life-changing trip. You know, my first trip to Ghana got me really started in just everything. So that was 2001. I was doing the second book, like I said. So yeah, that was, the first book was out. And Cultured Expressions was brand new. And I, you know, wasn't really, hadn't caught its legs yet, but I knew it was going to be something at some point. So I just kind of went with it. And that was the biggest blessing. So I've been going to Ghana almost every year since 2001, except for a couple of pandemic years I took off and now I'm back. But I missed it terribly for those couple of years. But it's been instrumental in the business and in just creativity and just my whole way of doing everything.
And you got to meet the king.
We met the king. It was funny because we thought we had a quote unquote appointment because Navica obviously put all this stuff together, our whole trip. We had a quote unquote appointment to meet him on a Tuesday and he didn't want to meet us until Thursday. So we spent the 2 days in the village, in the area, just meeting other people. And it was the best thing that could have happened because we really got time to soak up other things. You know, I got other interviews and it was just perfect. So just because you have an appointment, he'll see you when he wants to see you. It was one of those. But it was great. It worked out. We were talking to kids and talking to elders. It was fabulous. So we had no problem waiting. That was, like I said, a life-changing trip. It was just everything.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lisa, is there anything else about your business you wanted to share with us?
Yeah, just I'm at culturedexpressions.com. And we're on Facebook and Instagram at Cultured Expressions, just to keep everything simple. And we do everything from in-person shopping to the virtual visits, like I mentioned. I'm available for guilds to do lectures, whether virtual or in person, within 2 hours drive. And I'm just having a great time. So I always said I would do this until it's not fun anymore. And that doesn't seem to really be in sight. I do everything from teaching and selling the fabric, promoting it. I'm always happy to answer questions about the fabric. I love when people are interested in it enough to ask. It's just a great way to incorporate something new. A lot of people, they've been using African fabrics for a long time. It's nothing new, but I like to always bring out something that is of interest. Yeah, so I'll just keep doing it until it's not fun anymore, because I always say that, and it's still fun. I don't see that the end of it in sight. And just finding new people to enjoy it and enjoying what they do with the fabrics. It's a real exchange. It's not just always me teaching. I learn a lot of stuff too, and it's a great passion to share. So I'm just happy to share it. And I'm just fortunate that I can make a living at it. I just encourage people to try it for the sake of creativity and learning about another culture and just kind of appreciating what's around us.
And one more question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned going over to Ghana annually. Do you ever make those trips where you take people with you to share that?
Yeah, I had done some earlier. The last one was 2013. So I had done 2003, 2010, 2011, and 2013. By 2017, when I opened the studio, it was more than I wanted to do. And it was just difficult to juggle, because then I have to close the studio for 3 weeks, which is a lot. It's a big chunk out of a month to close the studio. And then it's also the prep work to put a group together. Just not something I just wanted to do anymore. It's a lot. And also travel has changed so much. So when people ask me, when are you going to do another group trip? And I just kind of give them that look, you know, and they're like, oh, it's like it says it on my face, and I hate to disappoint people, but it's just, you know, I'm older and I have less energy and it takes more to put together. Travel is not what it used to be. You have to really want to do something and really want to go someplace. I encourage people to go. I just can't be the person to take you. And then, like I said, the business has changed so much with the studio now, and just to get away for that much time, and not just the time, because I still go for myself, but it's putting the trip together, that pre-time of getting all everything in place. It's just more than I can do right now. So I'm not saying I'll never do it again, but it's tight right now.
Yeah. There's a lot of responsibility with that.
It is. And I do feel responsible. Even if we're doing the sojourns that are domestic, I still feel like I'm responsible for people. So we have the retreat coming up in the East Coast retreat is in just in a few weeks, actually. And then Santa Fe, which is, I think as of yesterday, that sold out, the sojourn to Santa Fe. But the sojourns are on the website if anyone's interested in doing that. We can also do custom sojourns. If you have a group that wants to put together a sojourn, we can usually accommodate that. And not to Ghana, but domestically. So we just offer a lot of different things. I do business coaching now, and I do, you know, customized activities and custom retreats and things like that. So basically, if someone says, can you do something? It's like, yeah. And if I haven't done it before, we'll work it out. You know, it's always just fun for me to do new things too. So that keeps it interesting.
Yeah. Oh, you're one busy person. Wow.
Yeah, it's good. This kind of busy is good. You know, mm-hmm. Not all busy is good, but this kind of busy is good. Yeah.
Well, Lisa, it was so fun having you. And I do want to mention, we may have noticed there was a little bit of a buzz. I actually heard a buzz and thought, is a truck passing by? Mm-hmm. But what happened was you were having an earthquake.
We did. A New Jersey earthquake, which is kind of unheard of. And I was just concerned it wasn't the furnace in the building blowing up. So I'm in the studio right now. And after I realized it wasn't that, I said, okay, it's everybody. But yeah, it was a first. So I said, Paula, let me call you back. So a little glitch, but we're able to make it through. So I'm thankful for that as well.
And this interview is so much fun for me. Thank you so much for sharing all the information you had.
Thank you, Paula. It's fun for me too.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You can find more stories on aquilterslife.com or subscribe on your favorite podcast player so each episode will be downloaded automatically. Also, I want to hear about you and your wonderful quilts. Please contact me, Paula Chamberlain, through the website to set up an interview. And as always, thanks for listening.